This week on The Big Show, four-time Black Reel Award nominee Michael Ealy will join us to talk about his latest psychological thriller, The Intruder. Earlier this week, we lost a cinematic pioneer when eight-time Black Reel Award nominee John Singleton passed away. We'll examine his enduring legacy and place in the cinematic pantheon. The smoke is cleared, and the largest opening weekend in motion picture history is now official. Where does the Marvel Cinematic Universe go next after a gargantuan $356 million opening? Plus, we'll have movie news with Wilson Morales from blackfilm.com and reviews of the latest films, including Long Shot, The Intruders, and a for real Avengers Endgame, all on the latest episode, Keeping It Real with Film Gordon. Let's go. Special edition. It is special edition of Keeping It Real with Film Gordon. I am Tim Gordon. Coming up a little later on in the show, as you heard in our tease, we'll have reviews of all the latest films in theaters, including Long Shot, The Intruder, and we want to give an actual review of Avengers Endgame, since I kind of tiptoed around it last week. We'll also have an interview with Michael Ealy, who will stop by and talk to us about The Intruder, this psychological thriller. And also, Wilson Morales will hang with us, and we will talk about the life and legacy of director John Singleton, who passed away this week after a stroke and had been in a coma for the last couple of weeks. Really bummed me out earlier this week, and I'm still sort of bummed, if you can kind of hear it in my voice. And Wilson Morales will also join us momentarily for his weekly segment, which is, you know, where he looks at entertainment. But before we get to that, I've been somber probably for about 4 or 5 days. John Singleton, 51 years old, and Wilson and I will talk a little bit more about his career in a second, but both Wilson and I have spent time around John Singleton. Met him years ago at ABFF. And spent time with him a couple of times at ABFF. I always am shaken when there's stories about people who leave us who are around my age, because it kind of feels like you can feel your own mortality in a situation like that. So I'm not going to get too deep with it, because we do have a show and I need to pep my energy back up. But yeah, it's a hard week, man. It's a hard week, but without any further ado, we're going to New York, man. We'll bring Wilson in right now. Wilson Morales, editor-in-chief of blackfilm.com. Welcome to the show, man.
Hi, welcome. You know, it's certainly one of the saddest weeks, you know, in a long time. When you have a pioneer like Singleton die, we saw it earlier with Luke Perry when he caught a stroke and then was in a coma. And I don't know what's going on now. Stroke seems to be, especially when these guys are in their early 50s.
Well, I think the question I have for you, and I want to get your perspective on this, is that you and I have both been covering entertainment and covering actors and films for a better part of over 2 decades, right? And you build relationships with people, you know, when you talk to them. You don't necessarily know or hang out with them, you know, but you build a rapport with them, and you see them either at shows or junkets or the things that we do. How do you feel, Wilson, when there's somebody who you've covered for a long period of time that you may not be close with, but you're close enough that they know you, you know them, and then something bad happens? How does that affect you?
Well, you know, the thing is, within the talent that we have in the Black community, Black film community, whether you're a director, actor, or anyone behind the scenes, you know, there is that close relationship, only because, you know, we've seen these guys, you know, depending on how old you are, you know, either while they've already made it or on the come up. You know, and somebody like John, you know, who came out in 1991 and burst through that scene, which I guess some may call it the Black Renaissance of filmmakers. We had a bunch of them come out that year, you know, and then throughout the years, you know, filmmakers, Black filmmakers, you never know when their next project's going to be. So they're still in the game. So over the years, as you mentioned earlier, you know, we would see John at ABFF, at Urban World, at different places, you know, and he would have projects here or there, you know, but at the same time, he would still talk to you. And he never had that ego, like, I'm big and let's not talk. He talked to you, whether you met him for the first time, whether you've been an acquaintance of his. I mean, I wrote earlier, he would always shoot from the hip, tell you what he thought, you know, raw honesty, whether or not this person's good, or this film is not that good, or something wrong with the script or something, you know, something like that, you know, and at the same time, you know, when he had projects, you know, he always introduced a new caliber of talent.
Absolutely.
You know, you go back to, you know, 91 with Boys in the Hood, with Morris Chestnut and, you know, Nia Long and, you know, Cuba Gooding Jr. Then you look at Baby Boy with Tyrese and Taraji Henson. Then you look at Four Brothers with Garrett Hedlund, you know, in there, you know, giving him a bigger role than, you know, than when he was just starting to come out, you know, Sofia Vergara, you know, who's in Four Brothers, you know, so you look back at the people who have been shepherded through John Singleton, you know, and he continues to do so, you know, and he's one of those guys that always, you know, because he's always at the forefront, whether it's project big or small, TV projects, you know, they always required attention. You know, so now that this void has been empty, or this spot has been empty, it's up to filmmakers now, whether you're male or female, to say to themselves, I have to try to do and keep up the legacy what John did in terms of making good products, making products, so that way, you know, he opened the door for a lot of newcomers to come in, and hopefully filmmakers take that and when they're doing their projects.
All right. Well, I tell you what we're going to do, Wilson. I wanted to keep you on because I wanted to do another segment about this. I'm going to go to commercial right now, and when we come back, I want to go more into detail about his filmography, which, you know, I think we haven't slept on it. I think a lot of other people have slept on it, but we'll talk about that. You guys, keep it where you got it. You're listening to Keeping It Real with Film Gordon here at 96.3 HD4, and that's DCRadio.gov. We'll be right back.
Sometimes it might get crazy. Always here for you, lady. Baby, I'm just trying to change the game.
Change the game.
So let me work the thing. Let me do my thing.
You're dumb and full of a little crazy. The only way you fuck, I bang your bed and bang the set. Tat on my neck, tech on. Yeah, yeah, watch your step. He won't focus, he'll just boss. As the I left him in dust. Trust your boss. Cuss and get drunk and talk big. Smack your so quick and dip. Hop on the site like we used to do.
All right, and welcome back to a special edition of The Big Show, Keeping It Real with Film Gordon. I am Tim Gordon, and we're also joined again by Wilson Morales of BlackFilm.com. And I want to bring into the conversation Charles Kirkland, who's also our show contributor here as well. Gentlemen, when we talk about the loss of John Singleton, let's talk a little bit about, for people who may not be acquainted with who this director, this writer, producer, director was, I should say. Of course, USC film student, wrote Boys in the Hood in 1989, got it as a, a student, you know, thesis, got it produced by Columbia, broke through and was so timely when it was released. Released literally 4 months after the Rodney King beating.
Yep.
So it felt like, you know, it was urgent. And it also, to me, the thing that I remember clearly about this is that Spike Lee had debuted 5 years earlier in 1986 with She's Gotta Have It. And it felt like when John Singleton dropped that movie, he became a voice as prominent on the West Coast as Spike was on the East Coast.
Right.
And it felt like those two were kind of kindred souls. And as I wrote in a Instagram post, it was interesting to me that, you know, John Singleton, along with groups like NWA and Ice-T, kind of opened my eyes to what was going on the West Coast in a way that Spike Lee and his films in hip-hop had introduced us to a lot of what we knew about the Northeast. Wilson, talk to me about your first impressions of Boys in the Hood in 91, this film that was the jewel of a stacked 91 class of 17 African-American directors and other minorities.
You know, what's interesting is that, like, as you mentioned, you know, Spike had already been out, and in 91, he came out, and Singleton came out, and all those other directors came out. But Singleton, when you look at those directors, and Spike were the only ones that became consistent with movies. You know, obviously, Singleton stood out amongst dope films because he got the nomination, the youngest one, so that propels him to get more work and have a bigger say as to the projects he wanted to do, and led him to become more consistent. You know, obviously, Robert Townsend and Bill Duke have continued to work, but they haven't had the same success that Singleton has as a director in terms of the status and so forth. They've continued to work, but nothing to that same level. You know, but then when Boys in the Hood came out, obviously, we had never seen films coming out of L.A., you know, and that portrayal. And as you mentioned, it came out during 91, and, you know, I think on the cinema, I think you introduced Bloods and Crips, you know, in the cinema during that time. And all of a sudden, you started seeing, and I think that was pretty much the height of, like, the gang violence, because I think earlier in the year, we had New Jack City, and we had other films during that time period. And so when Singleton came out with his film, he had a message to say, you know, and people continue to see it. As of today, in New York, the Tribeca Film Festival have announced that they're going to show Boys in the Hood today. I think today or tomorrow as a tribute. And you're getting other TV stations, whether it's BET or TV One, doing their tribute to John Singleton. He was a legend, you know, and the fact that these TV stations and places all over the country and world are acknowledging him, you know, and showing the films. And now you can look back at his other films and say, okay, let's give this more thought. It wasn't just Boys in the Hood. You know, you had Poetic Justice, you had Higher Learning, you know, some of those other movies that he's had. Some of them have messages, you know, to say, and people are going to be looking back to say, hey, you know, at the end of the day, Singleton had a vision and a story to tell you, and now you can hear it more clearly now that he's passed away.
Now, Charles, one of the other things that's interesting, and just as a sidebar, even before we continue on, I was going through Singleton's IG page, right?
Okay.
And interestingly enough, and what must be the strangest coincidence of all time, his childhood friend, I think his name was Michael Winters, and he called him Fatback, was his nickname, right?
Okay.
He died literally the same day John Singleton died, 1 year earlier. And this is the guy that the character Doughboy,
right,
Doughboy was based on. Mm-hmm. So they died one year apart to the day. And it was, I was like, wow.
Really freaky.
Freaky, really freaky. Freaky coincidence. But as Wilson was just talking about, I think the thing that struck me about John Singleton's career early on is that Boys in the Hood was such a profound film, right? So, of course, after that, Columbia Pictures, who he had a deal with, looked for every movie that John made to kind of be that urgent film. And John wanted to just tell stories, right? So, you know, a love story with Poetic Justice, you know, a story about education and racism on college campuses with Higher Learning. Mm-hmm. Baby Boy, which I think is another film that really sheds a light, that Taraji P. Henson, Tyrese film, Snoop Dogg, strong stuff. Did we, and I don't want to say did we take him for granted, but did we look at John's career after Boys in the Hood, and did we see his work as kind of a progression that he was continuing to grow, because he kind of moved out of the film space and into television space.
Yeah, right.
But do we look at his, I mean, what is his legacy as it relates to, and Wilson, you can answer this one as well after Charles, do we think his career, is there enough there that he's really like a director outside of Boys in the Hood? That's my question, because I've been struggling with this for a couple of days, trying to put Singleton's career into kind of.
I guess it depends on what sphere you're looking in, because I know in the hip hop realm he's a god. I mean, he used Snoop Dogg, Ice Cube, Busta Rhymes, all these hip hop icons were in his films, and so a lot of the culture nowadays, the people who I know, the younger people love Baby Boy and everything that that movie represents, because that's their story. And so just as much as Boys in the Hood was, Baby Boy is very credible as a story that people resonate with. And I think he really had a great filmography. I just wish it were bigger. You know, people wanted more from him. I think his work, though, the quality level is outstanding.
Wilson?
Well, think about it. Look what we're doing now. You know, Jordan Peele has two films, and we've put him on such a high pedestal.
Right.
Singleton.
Right.
You know, and that's just off of two films. You know, look at Barry Jenkins. Barry Jenkins has a total of three films.
He's
on a high pedestal.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, But look, today's social media, you know, we're putting these guys, you know, and it's a question of whether or not, time will tell whether or not these movies are classics. At the end of the day, they may have won accolades, but there's a lot of films that have won accolades and awards, but are they classics? That's the question. You know, is it something that, like, you can stay home if you're ready to leave and it's on TV and you say, I just want to see this one scene, you know? You look back and you look at Singleton's work, you know, whether it's Baby Boy, you know, whether it's Higher Learning, you know, whether it's Poetic Justice and Four Brothers, and, you know.
And his producing work on Hustle and Flow.
Think about Hustle and Flow that he produced, you know, and who he introduced. And he also did Frank Reyes.
Illegal Tender.
If he wasn't in front of the camera directing it, he was certainly producing it. And obviously, when you talk about Hustle and Flow, look what he did with Terrence Howard's career. You know, introducing Craig Brewer, you know, who's actually coming back to do Coming to America sequel. You know, so, like, John Singleton helped bring in some people into this business. You know, Don's, his script supervisor on Boys in the Hood, I forget her name. I think it's Dawn. I can't remember her last name. You know, she got her early starts through him, and if you don't know who she is, she's been J.J. Abrams' script supervisor for his last 15 projects.
Wow.
You know, so look at the work, the people that came along and worked with him and how they evolved in this business have gone on elsewhere. You know, that's who John was. You know, he brought in people in the game, you know, besides the story that he told. Sometimes it's just a matter of being a filmmaker. You know, like when you do movies like Four Brothers and Illegal Tender, you know, you just want to make a film. You know, so it's not everything's all about being a biopic or, you know, a documentary. Sometimes as a filmmaker, you just want to make a film. You know, granted, you started off with Boys in the Hood, and then you did Higher Learning, and then you did Poetic Justice, and then you get to the point where, like, some of these other movies were just commercial movies. You know, something that we can sit back at home and watch.
Too Fast, Too Furious.
Too Fast, Too Furious. Gave him his first $100 million film.
Yeah.
And once he got that, he was able to, you know, once you do $100 million, you have a bigger say in the business.
All right. Well, brother, Wilson.
I'm glad Wilson talked about, you know, all the people that worked with him, because we're talking about all the stars that worked under him as well. But, you know.
All right. Well, Wilson, you know, thanks to both you, Wilson, as well as Charles Kirkland, you know, for honoring the life of John Singleton, man. I mean, we could have gone on and on and on, man, talking about this guy's work, Snowfall, and some of the other things that he's doing as well, or had done as well. But Wilson, thanks, man. I appreciate you, man. I knew you had a perspective that we have on this. Tell people where they can follow your content, Wilson.
You can find me over at blackfilm.com, which is the same words you use for Twitter, Instagram, as well as Facebook.
All righty. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back on the other side, we'll sit down with Michael Ealy and talk about his role in Intruder. You guys keep it where you got it. You're listening to The Big Show, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is John David Washington, and you're listening to The Big Show. Keep it real. Film Gordon on Film Gordon Radio.
I heard from a friend today, and she said you were in town.
Several movies in theaters this week, but without any further ado, had an opportunity to sit down with Michael Ealy earlier this week. The interview you're about to hear is a very interesting one. It happened in a hallway, all right, in the middle of a hallway at the Four Seasons Hotel. Publicist sitting kind of like 10 feet away, people walking by. So when you listen to the quality, the thing that's interesting is the deeper we go into the interview, you'll notice it's almost like two brothers, man, just sharing some family secrets. Keep it where you got it. Here's my conversation with Michael Ealy.
My next guest is a gentleman whose work I've looked at for about the past 20 years. Everything from Too Fast, Too Furious, Think Like a Man, Think Like a Man 2, About Last Night. I mean, and on and on and on, including television work and Sleeper Cell and what was the series he played as an angel? Almost Human. Michael Ealy is a hometown guy. Went to the University of Maryland, born in Washington, D.C., raised in Silver Spring, Maryland. Mm-hmm. Michael Ealy, welcome back to the show, because we've had you on before. Yes. As we talked earlier, you're in town, man, promoting your brand new film, Deion Taylor's The Intruder.
Yes.
Tell the audience a little bit about this film.
So The Intruder is kind of a story about this newlywed couple that is out to pursue the American dream, and you know, they run into this big obstacle that is the previous owner, played by Dennis Quaid's character. Right. And his name is Charlie Peck, and he basically is that guy who turns the American dream into a nightmare.
All right, so let's get into this, man.
Yeah.
I thought that your character,
Scott,
exhibited lots of the common sense.
Yes.
That I look for in the thriller.
Right.
The interesting thing about this is that I had a long conversation with my girlfriend last night. Mm-hmm. After it was over. She was like, "Babe, how's the movie?" I said, I wish you would have been there, because if you would have acted like the Making Good character acted right in real life, you and I couldn't be together.
Right.
Because
that's interesting. Let's go.
And you talked about this, you know, at the talk back, or actually the intro last night, that it was a product, like you said, that it was two different perspectives. You saw him one way, she saw him another way, right?
Yes.
But still, I told my lady, we got to be on the same page.
Yes.
We got to see the same.
Yes.
You got to be quicker to the draw, because a situation like that could really happen. So I wanted to ask you, first of all, about this specifically, that in a situation like that, mm-hmm, when a story kind of turns out in that way, is that more a byproduct of the direction that you're getting from the person who created the story, like the director, screenwriter, or is it a way that it's being played or even edited to kind of, you know, create that kind of horror or thriller atmosphere?
Yeah, look, I'd be lying if I say there's not some manipulation happening to kind of keep the story going, right? To really kind of intensify the suspense so that the payoff works. There's the technical version of that in terms of storytelling. Now, as I told everybody last night, and I'll keep saying this in defense of Megan's character, is that the goal of a sociopath is to charm you and terrify you, right? So when you don't do it their way,
right.
Once you, you know, because where Dennis is and what Charlie is doing is presenting one version of himself to Annie and one version of himself to me. And that's where it becomes a bit tricky for Megan and the audience to understand that character, in my opinion, because the audience has the luxury of seeing both sides of Charlie. I have the luxury of seeing the one side of Charlie that I don't like. And so I am, in a lot of ways, the voice of the audience. And right. I think that's why it's easier to be like, oh, we got to... And I think by the time people feel like Annie is supposed to kind of be like, okay, but what about now? Like, I mean, isn't it a little weird they keep showing up? At that point, Scott and Annie, the work that Charlie has already done, Scott and Annie are already a bit frayed. And Megan talked about how she had to find a little bit of defiance to keep it going. Because you're right, the Megan... You know, Megan Good would never have let this go on for so long.
Right.
But
right.
Annie is feeling like, you know, and that's where that whole, the whole fight about having wine and not being there for the Christmas lights and all that stuff. It all starts to, like, and that's why I think sometimes a second or a third viewing, and I'm, you know, I mean that wholeheartedly, is where some of these things start to kind of fall together. Because, again, your initial response... I get it. When I read it, I was like, "What? Well, hold on now. Like,
what part are you not seeing?
Yeah, like, what part are you not seeing?
Right.
But you have the luxury, again, of seeing the whole thing. But if you just watched the Charlie and Annie scenes, you wouldn't think anything was wrong.
Okay, so I'm not going to beat a dead horse because I heard that. You said it last night and you've just kind of gone over it again. But I guess part of what I guess what lost me, right, and what I call the common sense factor, and this is cultural because I'm like, come on, man, y'all supposed to pick this up.
Right.
Is if you hear a guy say, you know, thank you, I've sold you my house and now I'm out, but he keeps showing up, at some point, your character put it together much quicker, apparently, than Megan Good's character. But the guy is always there. He's always showing up. At some point, there should have been some alarm bell. But again, that's my quibble with the film. And I'm the audience, as I saw him last night, people loved the movie. They thought it was suspenseful. They thought it worked.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm going to leave that alone, man.
But I will say this. Again, there are things happening in our relationship.
Right, and that's part of the backstory.
For example, when I'm putting up the alarm system and Charlie rolls up, she's already gone.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
She's gone, so she didn't see him pull up. She didn't hear me get into this conversation with him about guns.
Right?
So she didn't see, there's certain things that she's not seeing that I am seeing. And then, on top of that, there's a scene that happens in the with the tree and everything and blah blah blah, and what isn't clear is she thinks I just don't want the house,
right?
Because I don't. I didn't want to buy this house.
It was too expensive. She wanted it.
She wanted this house, but because of what I've done in my past. Mm-hmm. As a character, I'm overcompensating.
Right, and that's
which is something we all know.
But Michael, that's the other thing I wanted to talk about, because it's inferred that there's something that has occurred in the relationship.
Yes, in the past.
The scene, we're not going to give the movie away, but you know what I'm talking about. There's a scene where you call in because you're late with a client, and it's taken a certain way, and it's inferred that there is something that has occurred that has frayed or kind of put a strain on the trust of the relationship.
Yes.
So I thought that was handled quite well.
That was Megan and I working very closely together with Dion to try and make this couple grounded, and not like a Hollywood romanticized newlywed couple where everything is just butterflies. This couple has like a real past and they're really working together to try and push through it. That was important to both Megan and I.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about you specifically now. As I told you earlier, you've got 20 years of movies. I'm thinking, even as we talked, I did the intro, I forgot about stuff like Takers. I mean, you have done a gang of
almost
movies.
20. Yeah. Almost 20. Yeah, no, because Bad Company was 99.
It was 99.
Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, so, 20 years.
So here's my question for you. I looked through your filmography this morning, right? And I was trying to see if there was a thread or a theme that ran through your work. The only thing that I could think of, which I couldn't find, but I'm just searching, is that most of the characters that I've seen you play, no matter what they are, whether it's you in Barbershop, man, when you're playing
Ricky
the Thug, whether you're an Almost Human, there's always a level of sensitivity that you bring, and I think that's more you than it's the characters that you portray. I just think it's naturally, like, if you get Mike Wheelie and their eyes are watching God, you're going to get a level of sensitivity.
Okay.
You're going to get sensitive, Michael. Is that a part of, you know, your process of when you're, because I know I've read that you research incessantly the characters you're playing, trying to find something to kind
identify
of identify
with. Hold on to, yeah.
Right. So that level of sensitivity that you bring, how does that kind of, like that part of you, how does that kind of infuse the work that you do? Or is it just natural and it's just a part of your process?
Good question. I think, that's a real good question. I think, and something I've never really given a lot of thought to, I think I've just done it kind of naturally, and that is, whenever you're finding a character, you have to try and find something that you identify with, no matter how repugnant, repulsive, or corny, you know, this person is. So when you play Bo Willie in For Color Girls, and you can't imagine yourself dropping children out of a window, you have to find a way in so that you can really embody this person and what they're going through. And for me, it was the struggle of the importance of PTSD and having played a kid who was bipolar once. In another movie called Jelly Smoke, student film a long time ago. And the idea and doing all this research about PTSD and learning how it can just tear apart families. And it's not necessarily the PTSD, it's the war that's the real catalyst. Like, war is the real catalyst that leads to PTSD, which then leads to secondary PTSD, you know, for the caregiver of that person. And the veterans, you know, system and how debunked that is. And so all of that starts to form a context for which I can wrap myself around, okay, this dude was, a good guy, charming, stand-up, loving guy, loved his girl, blah, blah, blah. Went to the war, changed him. What does that make him now? So your base is that guy who used to be like you.
Right.
The war created this guy who's lost and doesn't even know how to ask for help. And when you watch interviews of soldiers who have been lost, it is awful, because it's technically, I'm trying to think, you realize how important it is, or how soulful you are, rather. And when that is gone, when that is torn apart and your compass is now off kilter, so what you think is north is no longer north, all of that is gone. Who are you inside? What is your fix? What tries to keep you sane? What could that be? All of that leads to, you know, me putting on 35 pounds for that role. And, you know, like finding just the not just darkness, but like literally like living in a world where this is painful. And is he cognizant that he put the kids out? Is he really cognizant that he did that? And it was an awful place to go to, but that's why I'm doing this. I think I grew up a pretty stable environment, in a stable environment, Huxtable X, if you will. And the joy that I get from kind of going to different places is why I've tried to create somewhat of a diverse body of work, as opposed to just sticking with Ricky after Barbershop. To be able to show the vulnerability of someone like Scott. I was explaining to somebody today, I never lost a fight in a Hollywood production. Movie, television, never lost a fight. I didn't know that until I had to lose a fight. And to lose a fight to Dennis under these circumstances was like, oh, okay, right. So I'm not the hero. And Dion was very adamant about that. He's like, I don't want you to be Ely. Like, I want you to be this tech guy that's not, he's not handy with ish. He can't put together a light bulb. He's that guy who's like, yeah, go pay somebody to fix that.
Right, you know what I mean?
Where we're headed. You know, and Dennis represents this old school man who, you know, built ish with his hands and hunts and all this other stuff. And right. What we've evolved from. And so there's this nice juxtaposition of us both. And for me, I think to kind of get to the bottom of your question and answer it, you know, yes, there's a part of me that is sensitive to who I'm playing and trying to bring out the humanity of each and every character. I'm very sensitive to that. And I think what I enjoy most is when people are aware of that, when they see it, and they don't just, you know, look at the physicality and say, you know, because I get that too. But there's more there. And I feel that when, especially when I talk to guys who are like, yo, yeah, like I respect your work, because I feel like I would have done it just like you.
Right, you know what I mean? I
would have played that the same way. Right. You know what I mean? And that means the world to me.
All right, here's my final question for you. In a year that we just had last year, where you have, and think about you as the individual, but also think about the art in a whole. As African Americans, we had a year of Black Panther, Bill Shooting Talk, The Heat You Get. We moved so far in a small amount of time. I've been doing a Black Real Award show for 20 years, and I remember what we were honoring 20 years ago, and now the slate of films that's kind of our tour that come along.
Mm-hmm.
You clearly are a part of that space.
Okay.
As a part of that space, how do you feel about the progression, not just of your art, but of the art of your peers as a whole, as you're looking at the movement? And do you think we're in a place now where we're continuing to push as we open in new doors for younger people like you've been to all of this speaking tours? There's a guy that's going to walk up to you in 5 or 10 years and go, I met you at blah, blah, blah.
That's been happening.
So how do you feel about where we are right now, moving forward in this cinema space?
I feel good. I feel good because we're getting more control over what we're putting out. One of the things I love about Dion, for example, is that self-financed. This was financed by a Black man.
Right.
That's big. And you know, like I said, learning the business side of things, it's very important to have control. Very important to have control. Now, in terms of what happened last year, in terms of Beale Street and Hate U Give and Black Panther, I think we're heading in the right direction. I personally would like to see us tell stories and not have everything so rooted in the pain of being Black.
I see what you're saying. Okay. I see exactly what you're saying.
Kind of what I liked about Black Panther, actually. You know, with Beale Street and Hate U Give, while they're good movies, they feel familiar in terms of the, and I was talking about this again with the Howard students, the Black aesthetic, and how the Black aesthetic has always been rooted in pain. And people like Romare Bearden, when I was studying these cats in college, these cats were like, what is the Black aesthetic and why does it have to be rooted in pain? Are we only defined by our pain?
Right.
If we did Baby Driver with Lakeith Stanfield as the driver.
Right.
Oh, that's just a story.
Right.
With Black people.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I think we'll have true progress.
Right.
When you can have cliffhanger and the lead is, you know, myself or Idris. You know what I'm saying?
Right, 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 right.
That to me is progress. But that to me is going to be real progress when,
right.
you know, again, people will look at this movie and think, oh, black couple, white man, I see the symbolism, blah, blah, blah. I see it. There's no talk of it.
No.
Because when you read it, it's not specific in the script. So, I personally, not to say that we don't need to emphasize our struggle.
Right.
For example, Hate U Give, that movie hurt me. The movie hurt me because we still didn't win.
Right. Right.
Yeah, we took down the drug dealer. But we took out our own. But with the cop? What about the cop? That's what I'm talking about. Like, that's why it hurt.
Right.
And like my boy said, yo, we still taking an L. He was like, I loved it. The performance is great. We still taking an L. And sometimes life imitating art or art imitating life, I understand that's the nature of the beast. That's right. The cycle. That's the wicked cycle. But that's also sometimes why people don't want to go. That's why a movie like that won't do well financially. Because people are like, yo, I'm watching the news. I'm watching the news and seeing this and being terrified. You think I want to go submit myself and pay money, submit myself to that storyline in a fictitious way? I'm not saying we shouldn't tell those stories.
Right.
I'm just saying there's, you know, there's going to be, I don't know how much progress we're making if we're still stuck on telling the stories of pain and suffering and always trying to do period pieces whereby, you know, we got to go back to a place where we're disenfranchised.
Man,
I'm Wakanda showed us on an elevated level, right?
I really wish I could have brought you in the studio because this would have been like a good half hour. We could have done this because I got so many thoughts because you're right. I think part of what the difficulty has been with certain films is exactly what you said, and I've said it as well, that people can watch the news. So you don't, you know, you try to bring people in to see something.
This is more, like, The Intruder, for example, is entertaining. Like, it's a popcorn movie, right?
Right, but of course there's the other part that you got to educate the audience because African-American audiences are in tune to look for the pain in these films, which is why these films continually get greenlit the filmmakers come and bring these stories in because they feel that there's an audience for them, but they don't branch out past that audience because, as you said, people are like, it's a real problem, man.
It is, and that's what I'm saying. We're not there yet. You know what I mean? We're not there yet. And again, it comes down to getting control of our own stories and putting out stories that, you know, it's fine to reflect what's going on in society and do something timely.
Yeah.
But it feels so heavy-handed in one direction. In one direction. And I feel like I like the balance of having a Think Like a Man movie where you kind of see well-off people that aren't caught up in the struggle, because not everybody is we're not a monolith, right? We are a diverse range of people with shades and various backgrounds and educations. It's all there. So let's show it all and not just stay stuck or rooted into this idea that a black story, a black movie has to have pain. When I watched Beale Street on the plane, I was like, I'm so tired of seeing brothers behind that glass, man. I've been seeing it for years. I'm tired of it. You know, I enjoy documentaries like The 13th that kind of break down the criminal justice system and show you how something like Beale Street could happen. Mm-hmm. I get it. But that movie broke my heart, man. Mm. Broke my heart.
All right, and I want to thank Michael Ealy. That was very informative, man. Great conversation. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back on the other side, it's going to be time to finally do a real review of Avengers Endgame. All right? If you haven't seen it by now, sorry. Either way, you got it. You're listening to Keeping It Real with Film Gordon.
Drop. Too fast. Drop. Too furious. I'm too fast for y'all, man. Drop. Too fast. Drop. Too furious. Oh, I'm too fast for y'all. Oh, you just came home from doing a bid. Tell me what you gon' do. Act a fool. Somebody broke in and cleaned out your crib. Boy, what you gon' do? Act a fool. Just bought a new pair and they scuffed your shoes. Tell me what you gon' do. Act a fool. Now them cops trying to throw you in them county blues. Boy, what you gon' do? Act a fool. Traps, cops, and robbers. It's 911. Please call the doctor. Evacuate the building and trick the pigs. Since everybody want a piece, we gonna split your
wings.
Welcome
back to the show. And of course, this week's reviews are brought to you by thefilmgordon.com. Experience film through the eyes of a true film addict. Not the most selfish man in radio, but minds. Check out all of our film content at thefilmgordon.com. There are three films that we're gonna review today. I was gonna say three films in theaters. There's actually more than three films in theaters. There's two we're going to review from this week, one from last week that we have reviewed. All right, but before we start with any of these reviews, cue the music. All right, first up this week is the film that our last guest, Michael Lilly, just spoke about. And of course, that film is The Intruder. The film stars Michael Ealy and Megan Good as a couple who buy a house in the country only to realize that its previous owner, played by Dennis Quaid, refuses to let it go. Man, let's check out a clip from The Intruder.
What?
What are you doing?
Oh. Well, I noticed that the grass was getting out of hand, so I just went ahead.
Did you just get this out of the garage?
That's where I keep it.
Huh. What happened to Florida? I thought you'd be gone by now.
It's hard to say goodbye.
All right, let's cut to the chase on this movie right here. Dion Taylor's The Intruder tells the story, as I told you, of a couple who fall in love. They want to expand their family. They fall in love with a wonderful house out in Napa. They move from San Francisco to this house where they have an owner played by Dennis Quaid who refuses to leave. Now, I could, you know, kind of give you a lot of that it's about it's a psychological thriller and, you know, let's just get to the chase. The chase is that my issue with this movie was that there's what I call a level of cinematic logic that should apply. And despite what Mr. Ealy said about, you know, the way Dion Taylor frames a story that one character sees it one way and his character sees it another way, it ain't make a lot of sense. So it's a movie that you can check it out. The audiences that I went to the test screening with seem to enjoy it. I sat next to the most selfish man in radio, Charles Kirkland, and I tried to leave, and he wouldn't let me. I was not a fan of this movie, man. I'm just going to tell you straight up. Haven't been a fan of either of Mr. Taylor's films, but that's just me. What do I know? I just have a show, and I'm a film critic for 27 years. I don't know everything. I could be wrong. I gave this movie a D. You may see it and see something different. Good luck. All right, up next is the romantic comedy Long Shot, directed by Jonathan Levine. And, of course, this film stars Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron. The plot follows a journalist who begins to spend his time with his former babysitter who's now running for president. The film also co-stars O'Shea Jackson, or as I like to call him, Baby Cube, Andy Serkis, and Alexander Skarsgård. Let's check out a clip from Long Shot.
But how does that work with you? Do you like date?
Yeah. I date. Generally, you know, with people who have similar lifestyles to me, people who travel a lot. It's hard to keep those things alive. I mean, who wants to follow me around the world and hope I have 5 minutes to be affectionate?
Yeah.
And honestly, guys don't really want to date women who are more powerful than them. They think they do, but it's a Dick Shriveler.
Oof. Mm-hmm. Dick Shriveler is my favorite Batman villain, though, so. You gonna ask why I'm still single?
No, I get it. It makes sense.
Yeah,
it all right, up. Here we go again. Again, people, I'm doing this because there's only so many ways that we can kind of talk about stories that I've talked about with you ad nauseum for years. The concept here is a man who, when he was a kid, who was shy, had a babysitter. His babysitter ends up being Secretary of State and is now running for president. He's a journalist who's recently been fired or resigned from a job and has been hired to come in and be a scriptwriter, for said candidate. And then we find out that not just politically she has a side, but we find out that the two of them have an attraction. This movie's cute. Seth Rogen's always funny. Charlize Theron is wonderful to look at. How plausible it is, it's just a movie. As I said earlier, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. We've seen these stories, you know, the boy next door, the girl next door. It was one more. He's out of it. She's out of my league. You know, it's a movie like that. I mean, you can check it out. To be perfectly honest, the next movie we're going to talk about is literally going to slay all these movies throughout the entire month of May. So, I mean, if you've watched Endgame 7 times and you need to see something else, this movie can work for you. If not, you know, I gave it a C. Not breaking any ground, not deep. Fun. It was good to see Charlize Theron do some comedy. Seth Rogen. And let's be honest, in a perfect world, I mean, no disrespect to Seth Rogen, but a man like Seth couldn't get a woman like Charlize. It's just not happening. Every time I watch these movies, I'm like, word. Seriously? No, it's not happening. A C for this movie. Long shot. It actually is not just the title, but it tells you its prospects at the box office. A long shot. Moving on to our last film. A week ago, when you listened to The Big Show, we did what I called a review of Endgame that we had to soft shoe it, and we didn't have to soft shoe it. We chose to soft shoe it because I didn't want to ruin the experience for people. I wanted people to go in fresh like we did. Well, that was last week.
It's time has passed.
Charles Kirkland joins me, and let's just get right into Endgame right now. Of course, we don't have to go in and set it up. I think it's kind of it's kind of known what this movie is. It's basically when we left these characters at the end of Infinity War. Thanos snapped his finger. Half the universe disappeared, including half of our comic superheroes. He went and sat down, and just the film went off. And I remember being at the screening. One of our colleagues screamed out, "That's it!
That's it!
That's it! That's all we got!" Yes, that was it. Marvel was like, basically, we picked the story up now. And since we picked it up, let's also set it up that we had Ant-Man and the Wasp. Ant-Man gets stuck in the quantum realm, right? Because when Thanos snapped his fingers, the Wasp, as well as Hank Pym and his wife disappeared. And then we had Captain Marvel, who came and, you know, found out end scene that Fury had disappeared.
Right.
So
snapped as well.
So now we move on to this film, and basically, the first, I would say, 10 minutes of the film, we're dealing with different characters who have watched their families and friends disappear, and they are all trying to come to grips with what grief and loss is really. Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man is adrift in space. Hawkeye's family is just vanished, and you know, so the film, of course, brings these characters back because we find out that Ant-Man is indeed alive. The gang come up with a plan. All right, we know where Thanos is. We need to handle our business. So the remaining Avengers, along with Captain Marvel, show up, quickly dispatch Thanos, And the credits started to roll. That was it.
That was it.
That was it.
It was done.
Now, I basically what I'm going to say from here is that the film accelerates 5 years into the future. Grief and loss is still kind of, you know, everybody's trying to move on.
Right.
Captain America is leading a grief counseling group.
with one of the Russo brothers.
With one of the Russo brothers in it. Robert Downey Jr. has now, since we assume he's married and has started a family. And, you know, what's her name?
Black Widow.
Black Widow is now kind of leading the crew,
running
the Avengers, and you know the folks, General Okoye, Captain Marvel, Rhodey, and the crew are all, you know, trying to kind of
Raccoon. And all
They're all trying to kind of do their thing. So here's what I would say about this movie, man. I went back and saw it again, second time last week, and I think it plays better when you're looking at it a second time, because you kind of know what's coming and you want to watch audience reaction and kind of feel it. And then you kind of think through the first 21 films and think of how they've kind of set this thing up. There's only one issue that I had with the film, and it's not technically an issue. It's one of the things that all my friends keep coming back to me.
Okay.
Because, you know, the film moves 5 years into the future.
Right.
For every character but one. And I understand why we can't move this character to the future, because he got movies coming out. He still got to stay where he is.
You talking about Spider-Man?
I wasn't going to say anything, because, you know, that was a like everybody aged.
Everybody did.
Except Peter Parker.
Well, I don't think any of the other people who got snapped aged. They came back at the same point from when they snapped.
Okay, cool. All right, that's a good answer. All right, that's pretty good. All right, I mean, both Shane and I, like,
my problem was always, you know, anytime you deal with time travel,
right?
I think you create different timelines, and I don't think they really explained it too well about how you know they've created these divergent timelines. But other than that, it was fine for me. I enjoyed this movie.
But here's the key. I think the big thing that I think the Russo brothers did really well with this, and the screenwriters did really well, is that they gave a showcase to what I call the core four. And I talked about this last week. What they did with the Incredible Hulk, I thought was mad cool. And also the dudation of Thor. If you didn't see Big Lebowski, you lost. He was literally the dude like that Jeff Bridges played in that film. So I still feel just as strongly about this film as I did last week. I don't really want to have to go into detail, but the Robert Downey Jr., the resolution of the core four, I thought was great. I mean, great.
And you really, we kidded last week about having seen the other movies. But if you really went back and watched the other, you really had to see some things in the other movies that preceded this one to really appreciate things that happened in this movie. Like some of the things, the resolution of things for Tony Stark and for Captain America. If you don't know the backstory from the movies before, and there's lots of it. I don't know how they kept track of all these things to put it together for this movie that, I mean, it harkens back to, Iron Man, the first movie. There's significant things that happened in Iron Man, the first movie, that they wrap up in this movie. And if you don't, if you have no idea what happened, it's hard for you to follow it.
All righty. Well, both Charles and I still stick with IA+. And that's all we got this week, man. Matter of fact, we got to get out of here because I got to go back and see it a third time. So I tell you guys, I'm sorry. Special thanks also to our producer,
Shane Lewis.
Yeah, him. And also, the most selfish man in radio, you are
Charles Kirkland
Jr. And I am Tim Gordon. As we tell you guys in closing every week, please see something good at the movies.
Oh, yeah, just in case.
Basically, for the next 4 weeks. All right?